Welcome to the latest edition of Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining me today, folks, because Life on Planet Porky means that I will tell you exactly how I see the way the planet should work, what my conclusions are about living on this planet. Planet Porky, of course, is also planet Earth, and how I can help and guide you through your lives, OK? Now, first thing I want to tell you is that I've received an awful lot of messages over the last few days, because you will have seen a picture on my Twitter feed of me posing underneath a sign which said MRI scam, OK? Now, MRI scam, no, it wasn't scam, I'm going mad. It said MRI, it's something like scam, but it's not scam. Now, it means an MRI scan, I beg your pardon. Scan as in N for nutter, not scam as in M for mother, if you see what I mean. So the MRI scan I attended quite recently. As you know, I do have a number of health issues which have, you know, dogged me for the last 20 years or so. Started off with my heart, of course, collapsing. Acute heart failure is not something most people get over, but I did. Don't worry about that. And now, of course, only one third of my heart works, but that one third is pumping away magnificently. Now, I've also got frozen shoulder. I recently, by the way, had a bit of a problem with my right hand. I trapped it in the door of my car, and I thought I'd broken my fingers, but in fact, it just got very badly bruised and damaged a couple of tendons. But that's all coming back. Don't worry about that. The sciatica is a constant problem, but don't worry about that, because I can cope with that as well. Now, you say to yourself, why would I go and have an IRA? No, not IRA. Sorry, that's the Republic of... No, it's not. It's the Irish Republican Army, isn't it? It's nothing to do with that. It's the MRI scan, OK? Now, why would I go? Well, let me tell you this. Because I try to work so intensely, my brain sometimes gets filled up. Now, I noticed over recent months, I was starting to suffer what I can only describe as sort of intense pressure on my head. Not really like a headache, but almost as if somebody had taken a bathing cap, if you know what I mean, you know, one of those tight bathing caps, you pull it over your head, the sort of thing that you would put on your head if you decided to try and make yourself bald and you were doing a pantomime and you're putting a wig on top of your head, if you understand what I mean, you know? And that pressure on my head was over the top of my head, the crown of my head, down back through my neck and sort of into my shoulders. And I thought, well, there's got to be something wrong here, so I'll go and find out. So, of course, I went to see the doc. They like seeing me. Saw the doc recently, by the way, about my diabetes, because I forgot to mention diabetes too, which, by the way, I've largely beaten. But you have to be on your mettle all the time to make sure you don't eat sweet stuff, don't drink sweet stuff, you know what I mean? And I've disciplined myself extremely well on that issue, as I think you will all agree. I'm looking better now than I have for a long time. Although you can't see me at the moment, you see plenty of me when you go into social media and follow the clues I give you about my life. So one of the clues, of course, the MRI scan. So when I went to see the doctor, and he's a great doctor as well, I explained all this problem on my head. So the first thing they did was send me for an X-ray of my head. And that's because they wondered whether it was coming from the top of my spine, neck up, you see. So I go and have this X-ray. And that was pretty straightforward. You stand in front of an X-ray machine, it goes bang, and then in the old days, by the way, when I was having X-rays with my heart and all that, I used to hang around for like 15 minutes, and then the radiographer would come out and would give you your plates, so to speak, and then you take them back to the surgery and show the doctor and all that kind of stuff. These days, of course, it's all digital. So I went along and had the X-ray on my bonce, my head, and that showed a little bit of compression at the top of the spine, but not really any significant damage or anything like that. They call it trauma. And suggested, you know, a bit of massage might just help out. The fact that I work or try to work so intensely does give you tension in those sort of muscles and nerves around the top of your head. You know, when you're thinking deeply, as I think deeply all the time, you will find that the intensity of the thinking process can, you know, as I'm talking to you now, I'm moving my head around in a fashion, circular fashion, as I'm watching a washing machine go around, if you see what I mean. Tumble dryer, I should say, going around, and that helps alleviate the pressure. Anyway, Having got the x-rays back to my principal doc, what I did then was went to see him again, and he suggested that there's probably nothing wrong, but did I have any history in the family of an aneurysm? Now, an aneurysm is a... it's something to do... I'm not a doctor, although I've seen plenty of doctors. It's something to do with the... there's a blood vessel in the back of your head. And like all other blood vessels in your body, it's pretty important it doesn't burst, because if it does, you'd have a real problem. You'd probably have a massive stroke or something like that. Lady Brady, that is Karen Brady, who is the vice chairman of West Ham United Football Club, a very distinguished football administrator and executive, had a routine medical or routine, checkup a few years ago, and she was told there was a little problem in that particular blood vessel. And she had some corrective surgery, and delighted to say all is well. Now, what they decided was, well, it could be the same thing. That could be putting pressure on your head. So I said, OK, what do we do now? They said, go for the MRI scan. Now, I have to say, the hospital I went to is called St Helier. It's in Surrey, a place called Carshalton. And they have a big unit there. And I went along. And it's quite interesting, actually. What they do is they put you in an MRI scanner. That's why it's called an MRI scan, obviously. And... and they only put the top half in because it's your head. But you go back into a tube-like thing. I've had an MRI scan before for my heart where they put your whole body in this this tube. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like you disappear into a miniature version of a tube train tunnel, so to speak. And it can discombobulate some people. For that reason, when you go into this machine, they give you a panic button. I.e., you have a ball in your hand attached to a wire, and if at any stage you start feeling that the walls are closing in on you, you know, claustrophobia and all that kind of stuff, you can squeeze your panic button and they'll release you. Now, I didn't need to do that, obviously. I'm used to these things, and I decided I can do this perfectly well, no problem at all, OK? So, you go into this machine, and what happens is... there's an awful lot of banging and noise about. They give you earplugs and then they put covers over your ears because they're talking to you about what's going on to talk you through the process. But an awful lot of banging, and it goes on for about 20 minutes in my case to give an all-round view of my head. Now, the interesting thing is, folks, that I haven't yet had the results of that, but one of the reasons I was concerned about the aneurysm thing was, sadly, I have mentioned this to you in the past because I know you're all regular listeners in the various forms of broadcasting I've done over the years. But sadly to say, it was about 20 years ago, just over, I think, about 21 years ago, 1998, when a very good friend of mine, a lad called Ian Sangster, who I knew as Sangy, collapsed and died in his kitchen of a brain aneurysm. And I have told the story before, but just to recap on it, his girlfriend was with him cooking in the kitchen. Sangy got out of the shower. It was a nice sunny day. Wrapped a towel around himself, went into the kitchen. Inveterate smoker, used to smoke about 40 cigarettes a day. Cigarette in one hand, glass of whiskey in the other. His girlfriend was cooking dinner for him at the flat they lived in. And he just keeled over backwards and died. A terrible, terrible shock. He was a young man. He wasn't yet 40, I don't think. I think he was about 38 or something like that. He's a bit younger than me. No, he would have been. Yeah, about 40, 41, something like that. And... I went to his funeral, it was terrible, all his young friends came along and all that, and a terrible waste of his life. And the terrible irony of that is that both Sangy's parents were doctors, both his mother and father were doctors, so, you know, they would have seen him at regular intervals, and I'm sure a doctor, if he'd thought there were any signs whatsoever of his son having any kind of, you know, situation in his head. Don't know whether doctors can spot that through the eyes or whether they can spot it through, you know, a slur in speech or something like that. But it was never picked up and sadly he's gone. So I wanted to make absolutely sure I wasn't going to, come to that end if possible, and for that reason I went off and did the MRI scan, and as I say, I'm waiting for the results and I will give you those results when I get them, OK? Right, OK, folks. Now, I want to tell you a Fleet Street tale, OK? And you might say, well, we've heard a few Fleet Street tales from me in the past. Yes, indeed, you have. But funny enough, I was working in central London last week. I was doing a bit of television, actually, with Jeremy Vine, terribly nice chap. And by the way, I met an extraordinary person during the course of that show, Jeremy Vine on Five, called Bianca, who is the world's leading drag artist. He's a chap whose name I think is Ron, and he does this impersonation of Bianca LaRue, I think it is. Oh, no, it's not LaRue. No, it's Danny LaRue, isn't it? Bianca somebody. But very nice guy and terribly powerful. American, won the American version of Drag Queen and all that kind of stuff. And we did this show, and that show's in one part of town. Then I had to get over to Blackfriars to see other people. Now, Blackfriars is just at the end of Fleet Street. Ludgate Circus is at the bottom of Fleet Street. And I had to get to Blackfriars, sort out some business there. And then I thought, well, why not take a stroll up Fleet Street and see what it's like these days, because, of course, it used to be my home. And as I walked down the road from Blackfriars and got to Ludgate Circus, I looked up at the wall plate on Fleet Street, and believe it or not, it said Fleet Street, OK? Now, you might say that's a bit obvious, but what I'm saying is the impact of that name to somebody who's been a lifelong journalist is still immense, and I mean immense, because when you're a young kid working on the Chester Chronicle in Chester, you honestly have ambitions and ideas and dreams and hopes that you will one day aspire. Certainly in my day, you would aspire to reaching the temple in the sky, which is Fleet Street. Very few people did, even though I say that myself. Very few people ever get there. But if you're determined and you want to do it, and I was very determined indeed, I decided I had to. And do you know what? It took me 7 years from the time I entered journalism to becoming the Daily Express correspondent in New York via regional papers in Birmingham and Newcastle, via working for the Daily Express in Manchester and then being transferred to Fleet Street and then getting the plum job. The plum job is correspondent New York, and I did 2 years there and 18 months in Washington, D.C. A glorious, glorious chapter of my life. And also the stepping stone, the platform to everything else I've done in my life, because unless you have that American experience, unless you were able to, you know, broaden the things you did in journalism so beautifully and so expansively by working across America and the Caribbean and Canada and South America, you'd never have got anywhere. So I was very lucky indeed. So as I see the Fleet Street sign, little bell goes off in my head, really, and the reminiscence of all those years ago when I was there, a young lad, you know, with my mid-20s, mixing with a lot of other young fellas and young ladies, by the way, some terrific female journalists I met during the course of my career, and some terrific older female journalists like Jean Rook, who was known as the First Lady of Fleet Street, and just tremendously gratifying stuff, you know. So I walk up Fleet Street and I walk past the old Daily Express building. It's called the Black Lubyanka, built by Lord Beaverbrook. It's made of black glass, and there's an exact replica of that building in Manchester, and there's another exact replica of it in Glasgow, where we had a separate Scottish Daily Express in those days when I was working there. But anyway, I go past the Daily Express, and then the next building along is the Daily Telegraph, the old building, the famous clock hanging outside, and that has now become a merchant banker's HQ. And eventually I get up to the Cheshire Cheese, and this is probably Fleet Street's most legendary pub. And they always cook their own pork pies. So I had a pork pie and a pint of bitter in the Cheshire Cheese, which is made up of about half a dozen or maybe eight separate little rooms down in the cellars, up on the first floor, down at the back of the pub and all that kind of stuff. Absolutely glorious. But the one thing I'd kind of forgotten was just how many Americans still come to Fleet Street to see the home of the newspaper industry, and in particular head into the Cheshire Cheese. And I wish the Cheshire Cheese would now start banning them, because they are a blinking nuisance, believe me. I got in there, I wanted to sit down with a newspaper because it was just off Fleet Street. And right at the top of the alleyway, by the way, where the Cheshire Cheese is what used to be Samuel Johnson's house, OK? So Samuel Johnson, one of the great thinkers and philosophers of his day, of his age, in the 1700s or whatever, used to gather with all his mates in the Cheshire Cheese, and they would talk through the problems of the world, the problem of life, and that's why Fleet Street ended up where it was, because these philosophers started what they called coffee houses, where people started talking, and then they started putting what they were talking about into print. On the other side of Fleet Street, there's the Caxton Press, where some of the first words ever printed, many hundreds of years before that, by the way, had been established near St. Bride's Church. But the Americans really get to me, because they come into the main room at the Cheshire Cheese, a small room, table at the back, sitting there with a newspaper and a freshly cooked home pork pie, right? And I'm getting through it, and then all these Americans start coming in, and I can't stand this expression the Americans use. You know, ha-ha, the folks back home told me I got to get in the Cheshire Cheese. We know you all the way from Seattle. And Seattle, by the way, is one of the world's most boring towns. I mean, the fact that it's home to Microsoft and Bill Gates has got one of the biggest individual residences in the world there is one thing. But Seattle itself, I mean, famous for sort of aviation and all that kind of stuff, but really a very boring town. It's so far away. It's about as far away from New York as you can get on the other coast, as you know, bordering Canada. And all these people come all the way from Seattle to Fleet Street, and then they sit in the Cheshire Cheese with half a pint of bitter and reminisce about, you know, the folks back home and take loads of pictures and all that. But they get in the way. They're a blinking nuisance. Having said that, Fleet Street's dear to my heart, so I want as many people to come and see it as they possibly can. But every time I go to Fleet Street, I remember a story. I remember a story about a great colleague who was thrown out of a pub because he'd had too much to drink, or didn't get in the pub because he had too much to drink, or left the pub and went to the wrong job because he was too inebriated, or, you know, was carried out of the pub, or sometimes summoned out of the pub. I mean, Fleet Street at its best. You'll never find the camaraderie of a workplace anywhere in this world like you found in Fleet Street, where ostensibly you're working against each other, but it was a village. But it was a village of cranks, of eccentrics, of genius, of talent, of shysters, of hard work. But my God, what a privilege it was to work there for 20 years. Now, what else can I tell you about life on Planet Porky? Well, I've got a major crisis here to report to you. It's about bananas. Yeah, OK, don't all snigger. Bananas, beautiful things. You love them. Do you know what? I've always had this feeling about bananas that I can never really taste the perfect banana. And I've put this question to nutritionists over the years. Why is it that when you eat a banana chew when you're a little kid, when you have a banana milkshake, which I used to before I got diabetes too, so I can't have any more banana milkshakes because it would kill me, because my blood sugar levels would get so high, something would burst inside my body. So why is it, folks, that things which are pretending to be banana, like a banana split ice cream, taste more like banana than bananas? Do you get what I'm saying? You can get banana essence. You can buy it in little bottles and you put it into cakes. And a banana cake tastes more like banana than bananas do. Why don't bananas taste like bananas anymore? The answer is because, of course, they're not as real, the bananas, as they were when they first came to this country. Now, we import 5 billion bananas into this country every year. And down at my place on the coast in Gosport, I often see the Fifey's banana boat coming in, right, off the Solent into Portsmouth Harbour. I'm not sure if it's come all the way from the Caribbean, or the Caribbean, as we call it in this country, or whether, you know, it's come from Africa or wherever. But I know we get a lot of our bananas from the Caribbean, and I want to put the premise to you now that we are in difficult, despairing times because bananas could disappear altogether. And I'll tell you why. There is a banana disease sweeping the world, OK? Can you think of life without bananas? Bananas are the sort of things that we eat to fill that gap in our stomachs in midday, to give us a bit of energy. And also, I think they have sodium in them, which is very good for you. They don't have vitamin D. That comes through other things, including sunlight, but they are very good for you. Now, do you remember that popular 1920s song? Yes, we have no bananas. That's a bloke who's apparently running a Greek fruit stand who begins every sentence with yes, and yes, we have no bananas is a skit on the fact that bananas are a common part of our language and always have been. Now, what I have to tell you, folks, and I'm reluctant to tell you this, but I have to, is that there is a devastating banana disease sweeping through countries that grow the fruit, OK? The situation is so serious that we might have to halt imports of bananas into this country. And I've told you there's 5 billion a year come here. Just imagine looking at a mountain of 5 billion bananas. Just imagine it, folks. I mean, it'd be bigger than, I don't know, maybe Mount Everest, which I'm going to tell you about, by the way, in a future podcast. There's trouble with Mount Everest all over the place. But what I'm saying is it's almost impossible to imagine that quantity of bananas. Anyway, what's happening is that this disease is already restricting supplies to greengrocers in this country, and it might mean there will be no bananas. Now, how do I know this? The thing is that banana farming is what's called monocultural, right? Now, a lot of you won't know what monocultural farming is, but I do. It means plantations have only a single species, because cultivating just one type of banana plant means increased yields for the farmer and better profits. And did you know, because I do, because I've studied bananas before, no, really, I think they're a fascinating subject, a banana tree stroke plant only ever flowers once. So when those bananas have grown, it's cut off with a saber type thing, you know, like a machete, and then it doesn't grow again. That's it. That's the end of that banana plant. You see what I mean? So you have to find more banana plants elsewhere. That's why you need so many of them all over Africa and the Caribbean, everywhere else. Now, the fruit we eat in Britain, right, because I've done all my research here, it actually comes from what we call one cultivar, not cultivator, cultivar, and it is the Cavendish sweet banana. That is the major banana in this country, the Cavendish sweet banana. Remember that, please. Cavendish, quite a famous name in this country. And 50% of bananas worldwide are Cavendish, and 99% of them that come into this country are of the same cultivar, OK? But the problem is, because the Cavendish is so much better to grow, because it's so prominently distributed throughout the world, it's highly susceptible to a strain of what we call the Panama disease. So Panama, obviously, is where the canal is. It's also a form of hat, but it's now also a terrible disease. So you've got Panama Canal, you've got Panama hat, you've got Panama the country. Now we've got a fourth definition of Panama, and that is, it's a disease, OK? So let me tell you, it's devastatingly infectious. It's a fungus. It destroys the plants from the inside, causing them to wilt and collapse, wiping out whole plantations. Now, some of you may or may not have recently seen the terrific TV series Chernobyl, OK? And if you have, you'll see the way a human being can explode from the inside. You'll have seen the gruesome pictures of people's insides unfortunately coming out through their mouth, of it coming out through their ears, of their faces turning to jelly, of their ears and nose bleeding, of their hands turning black and their fingers dropping off. Now, all that is happening equivalently to bananas, because they're being hit by the Panama disease, OK? And so far, this strain of Panama disease has ravaged plantations in Southeast Asia, in China, in Australia, in Africa and the Middle East. Bananas are massively under attack. We might lose them all. Please be aware and campaign, if you can, against the dreaded Panama disease. Do you know what? I've always had this feeling about bananas that I can never really taste the perfect banana. And I've put this question to nutritionists over the years. Why is it that when you eat a banana chew when you're a little kid, when you have a banana milkshake, which I used to before I got diabetes too, so I can't have any more banana milkshakes because it would kill me, because my blood sugar levels would get so high, something would burst inside my body. So why is it, folks, that things which are pretending to be banana, like a banana split ice cream, taste more like banana than bananas? Do you get what I'm saying? You can get banana essence. You can buy it in little bottles and you put it into cakes. And a banana cake tastes more like banana than bananas do. Why don't bananas taste like bananas anymore? The answer is because, of course, they're not as real, the bananas, as they were when they first came to this country. All these people come all the way from Seattle to Fleet Street, and then they sit in the Cheshire Cheese with half a pint of bitter and reminisce about, you know, the folks back home and take loads of pictures and all that. But they get in the way. They're a blinking nuisance. Having said that, Fleetway is dear to my heart, so I want as many people to come and see it as they possibly can. Now you say to yourself, why would I go and have an IRA... Sorry, that's the Republic of... No, it's not. It's the Irish Republican Army, isn't it? It's nothing to do with that.